Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
We're going to go through chronologically what I would consider lesser known titles. Now, I know this community is very well versed in music, so some of this may be obvious to you.
Hey there, peoples. This is Jim Lenihan here on Rockin' the Suburbs. All right. It is an exciting time here at the podcast because Patrick Foster and I are going on summer vacation. That's right. So for the next 2 weeks, you are going to hear some guest hosts, a couple of guest hosts. So first, let me tell you about the summer vacation. Well, this week is Suburbs Fest in Knoxville, Tennessee. So we're going to be off all this week. And then next week is Suburbs Fest Recovery. So we're going to be off all next week too. So what you're going to hear these 2 weeks are some guest episodes, a whole series of guest episodes put together by Paul Hayden and Vasanth Ramamurthy. And they are going to talk about punk for 2 weeks. It's a 10-part series. So here we go. This is part one. The guys are going to talk about proto-punk and get a little bit into first wave American punk here on Rockin' the Suburbs. Take it away, guys.
Hey, Rockin' the Suburbs. It's Paul Hayden coming to you with an episode about punk rock. And the theme is how punk rock saved our lives. And joining me today is...
Hey, this is Vasanth Ramamurthy.
Thanks for joining me, Vasant. How did this all come about?
Yeah, we were on a Rock in the Suburbs listener chat, and then I think Patrick Foster was asking some requests for his radio show, Red Hot and Brew, and then I noticed you a couple times had requested some pretty deep cut punk stuff that maybe I thought only Patrick and I would know about, and so I noticed that you must have been a fan as well, which I wasn't aware of. So I made an offhand comment about how it'd be interesting to learn about your punk rock history, and that spawned this episode, basically, where both of us could get together and talk about it.
Yeah, it was great timing because I had tossed around an idea of doing a podcast about some obscure punk records that a friend suggested to me, and it sounded like a good idea, but it wasn't really taking shape. And then I think when we met, when we crossed paths on the transom, it all kind of came together. So I thank you very much for offering to collaborate and also for putting together a great timeline that's going to help us work our way through the history of punk rock. So what I thought I'd do is just do a really brief intro is how did we discover punk rock? And I'll start. It was back in 1982. I was a freshman in college, and I was living in a dorm. And right around the second week or so, I think everyone had time to figure out who were the music guys, and there were about six or eight of us that were pretty passionate about it. And there was a guy there named Ed, who was from Pennsylvania, and he was just way ahead of everybody. He already knew the punk stuff. He already knew, the CBGBs and all that stuff. So he asked me if I'd ever heard the Sex Pistols, and I said, kind of sneered and said, well, yeah, I've heard of them. But remember, this is 1982. They were out 76, 77. I do remember seeing, news clips of this, band that couldn't play, singer couldn't sing, or spitting on the audience, and there's all this associated violence. And I thought, right. Well, this doesn't sound like anything I don't want to listen to. And of course, back then there was nowhere to hear it. I mean, there was no radio station was playing them. So
Were you
unless
like
you
a
had,
classic rock listener at that time?
I had the traditional rock upbringing, all the classics, Beatles, Stones, The Who, and then actually kind of dipped my toes into the new wave stuff through a coworker. And so I was had a couple of Elvis Costello records and Talking Heads and Diva, but nothing that I would consider like, pure punk. So
Sure.
this was so he said, well, I see what's in your collection, and this isn't really that far off musically. So let me make you a tape. So he made me a TDKS A90 with the Sex Pistols on one side and Gang of Four's Entertainment on the other.
Nice.
And I had my Walkman I use when I walk to and from class, and as soon as I heard it, man, I was hooked. I just thought this is what I like speed, I like energy. Just had all of that, and since then, I'm still addicted. How about you, Vasan? How'd you come across punk rock?
Well, I would say, and I'm a little bit younger than you, so my timeline has shifted a bit. So, for me, I would say it was probably Nirvana for sure would be the first one. So, when 1991 is when Nevermind came out, that's when I became aware of them. So I was 12 years old then. So I remember seeing the Smells Like Teen Spirit video on the MTV Buzzbin. I think I used to watch MTV before going to school in the morning, and I remember seeing that one morning and like couldn't get it out of my head after that. So yeah, like became like before that I was just listening to basically whatever was popular at the time, like a mix of, at that time, like Vanilla Ice, Hammer was popular, and but then also a little bit Metallica and Billy Joel was still around, and the other Motley Crue, Poison, all that, like pop music was kind of weird period of that time. Paula Abdul and everything, right, was popular. Whereas now, rock is not popular at all. But at least at that time, there were some rock bands that were popular. So I liked all that. Didn't have any specific taste, so to speak. But yeah, once Nirvana hit, I went all in into all those bands: Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and everything. But as far as like, I didn't really, those bands are obviously all influenced by punk, but not punk per se. But really, it would be a few more years until I actually got into more of the true stuff. I have an older brother, and so like 5 years older than me, so he had some stuff that he had, like the Velvet Underground and like Stooges Funhouse. So I sort of started borrowing that a few years later, listening to that. The real, I would say, Genesis for me was the summer between high school and college. So that was 1997. I just had a lot of free time that summer, so I would go to the library and I got this book called The Spin Alternative Record Guide, and that has, pretty much every important alternative music, punk, new wave, whatever records in there. And luckily the library I was going to had a very good CD collection, and so I was able to borrow CDs that summer, like the Modern Lovers, self-titled, Buzzcocks, Single Going Steady, Sex Pistols, The Pretenders, like, so basically your foundational records I all pretty much heard that summer.
You cross the street, cause you're
precious.
Moving through the Cleveland heat, how precious. You're taking that and all the kicks are so precious.
That was pretty big for me. And then after that, once I went to college, got involved in college radio, like from the start, freshman year. So I had access to the whole, at that time it was mostly record collection. And so I was able to listen to that. And then, yeah, so that's pretty much my journey. I've been a fan of stuff ever since then.
Awesome. Yeah, we're hoping that people out there have similar stories and would love to share them with us. But yeah, it doesn't matter how you got there as long as you get there, right? So
Right.
that's what we're gonna talk about now. So what we're gonna do, we're gonna go through chronologically what I would consider lesser known titles. Now, I know this community is very well versed in music, so some of this may be obvious to you, but yeah, we're hoping to reach everybody who maybe even has a passing interest or was maybe curious about where to go next after you have the foundational titles. So we're going to go through each a bunch of eras. We're going to each pick one or two records to talk about, then some honorable mentions. And what we're not going to talk about are politics, fashion, meshing. We're going to really stick to the music here.
Yeah,
So,
this is not a social history. It's more just albums we like from the various eras and genres.
So the first we're going to start out with what we're going to call the proto-punk era, and Vasant's going to start us off with his choice or his first choice from
Yeah.
this era. What do you got?
So I'm going to talk about the band Death, not to be confused with the heavy metal death metal band called Death, but this is a band from Detroit called Death. Actually, they have a documentary about them called A Band Called Death. So they were around, formed in Detroit in the early 70s. So it's interesting. It's a band of three brothers who happen to be African American, which is somewhat of a rarity in the, at least in those days, in the punk scene. So the interesting story about them is they recorded this album in 1975, so this is even before Ramones, but like, you know, after, obviously after MC5 and Stooges and stuff. But it sort of got shelved. They released like one single that was sort of a became a collector's item later, but really 2009, this record got unearthed, and the Drag City record label put it out in 2009. The album's called For the Whole World to See. And after that, it sort of became more widespread. People caught on to what sort of been a true collector's item all those years. So back in the day, they sort of had a missed potential. They were signed to Columbia Records, and at the time, the label head was Clive Davis, who later moved on to Arista Records. He was urging them to change their name because Death is a very unmarketable name, obviously. But they refused, and they stuck with it. And unfortunately, they, you know, sunk into obscurity. But yeah, this is a really cool record. It's interesting because of the fact, they are African American, so there's a it's not just Stooges and MC5 influence, but also there's a definite their the bass playing on this record is definitely influenced by funk and soul, and the vocals as well are very sort of soul influence. You can hear it in some of the songs. So yeah, Death for the Whole World to See would be my pick. Again, I think more people know them now just because the documentary is out and the record has been reissued, as I mentioned, but still sort of, it's not, people may not be aware that, you know, there was this band, that American band, that was around, you know, even before the Ramones and stuff, and doing it in Detroit.
Yeah, I took a listen to it as I was not familiar with the music. I'd heard the band name probably when the documentary came out, but when I listened to it, I said, this does not sound like 1975. Like this band was definitely, there's a couple songs that sound maybe of its time, but then You've got Politicians in My Eyes, which is definitely, I mean, that's like total punk rock.
One, two, three, now!
The performance, that was the one that really stood out for me.
Yeah.
And did they ever tour when they were rediscovered?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, they sort of, one of the brothers died some time back, so they have sort of played in some form. I think one of the guy's sons has filled in, and he has another band as well. So they're not really active much anymore because they're out there much older now as well. You know, the guys are probably in their 70s, if not older. So yeah.
Good point. All right, good choice. Good way to start everything off. I'm going to jump in with my choice, which is Pere Ubu. The album is called Terminal Tower. And one thing I would like to add here is that the records we chose are kind of like the records in our collection. This Pere Ubu's album is a compilation. There may be a newer version, there may be a better version, but we're going with the versions we know, and you can't go wrong with Terminal Tower. But first of all, Pere Ubu, if you're not familiar, formed in Cleveland in 1975, and along with Television, they started a new wave of rock by releasing singles on independent labels. They decided that it wasn't worth dealing with a major who may not even want anything to do with them. So they said, well, we're going to do it on our own terms. So their plan was to release two singles and then disappear. But the singles, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo and Final Solution, were big in New York, London, and Paris. They really caught on with kind of those in the know. So they decided to stay together. And their songs, they feature like off-kilter rhythms. Then you've got David Thomas, who just crazed vocals is the best way I can put it. It's all over the place, but
30
always stays in the pocket.
Tokyo. 30 seconds over 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 Tokyo.
The flip side of 30 Seconds Over Tokyo is Heart of Darkness. And that song's even more menacing than the other two. And it influenced bands like Mission of Burma, who we're going to talk about later. And I think as an introduction to the band, Terminal Tower is a really great snapshot of what they were doing in the beginning. And if you were to take it to the next step, their albums, The Modern Dance and Dub Housing are certainly worth your time. But this really captures that first, and you can hear in the songs that, this is something that the subsequent punk rockers took note of. And you could argue they probably feature in a lot of the other bands we're going to talk about today.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. This is a great pick because I love this this singles collection as well, just because it has their essential early stuff. This is one of the ones that I also found that summer of 97. So, and with some luck there, I think that's the same year, or maybe the next year, that Geffen happened to reissue this compilation on CD. So I was able to pick it up right then. But yeah, this is great stuff. Yeah. And I think one thing we should mention is our definition of punk is very loose. So like this, we're calling this proto, but like the whole, all the stuff we're going to talk about can be debated, you know, what genre it actually falls under. So yeah.
Yeah, I think we decided punk is more of an attitude than anything else. I mean,
right.
It's certainly taken on a lot of shapes over the years. And, you know, to me, it's just sort of like, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to follow my muse, whatever you want to call it. And I'm going to stick to what I think is, you know, what I want to say and how I want to say it. And you know, if you don't like it, that's fine. But I'm not going to, we're not going to follow trends or what the record company wants us to do. We're just going to do what we want.
Yep. Yep.
All right. So what do you want to talk about next?
Okay. The next band, I guess, would be considered a brother band of Perubu, and that would be the Dead Boys, with the album Young, Loud, and Snotty. So before Perubu and Dead Boys, there was actually a band called Rocket from the Tombs, which featured members from both the bands, and they split up. Rocket from the Tomb split up and basically split up into two bands. One was Perubu, sort of the more, Paul, as you mentioned, the more avant-garde experimental side, whereas the Dead Boys are more street-level rock and roll. So it featured Cheetah Chrome and Johnny Blitz, who were in Rocket from the Tomb. So that's the guitarist and the drummer. So they were also in Cleveland, but they later moved to New York. In a few years after that, to sort of playing the CBGB scene. So this album came out in 1977. So, you know, right around the U.S. Punk scene getting started, you know, a year after the Ramones and the same year as Talking Heads and all that. You know, the one note I have, which I will read verbatim on my doc, is sick ass riffs. That is pretty much how I would describe this album. And the two songs I think that fit the bill, my favorites on here, are Sonic Reducer and Ain't Nothing to Do. Sonic Reducer was actually covered by Pearl Jam, and that's actually the first place I heard this song. There was a pretty famous, at least for people of my age, Pearl Jam concert they played in Atlanta in 94, I think it was, that was broadcast on the radio all over. So, you know, me being a 15-year-old Pearl Jam fan, you know, I taped that show off the radio and all that. And so they're playing songs, from like Verses of Vitology and stuff. And, one of the covers that they played was Sonic Reducer. And at that time I had no idea who it was. I thought it was a cool new Pearl Jam song, and like the riff was insane. Yeah, that's the first place I heard it. And then as far as the song Ain't Nothing to Do, that was also covered by Green River, which is the band before Pearl Jam, featuring some of their members. And so that was, they covered that song on one of their albums in the late 80s there. So that's where I heard that, that tune. Another interesting thing about this album is that if you have heard of the mixing engineer Bob Clearmountain, he's done a lot of pretty famous albums, recording and mixing and stuff. He actually plays bass on this album because it was a Sire Records release. So,
whoa.
The
Oh.
you had the big guns like Bob involved on this. And then as I mentioned, since they were based in New York, John Belushi, people may not know, was a big punk rock fan. He actually played drums for them at a concert in New York later in the 70s. So there's some bad quality video of that on YouTube if you want to check that out. John Belushi, of course, booked the punk band Fear to play on Saturday Night Live in like 80 or 81 or so. But yeah, Dead Boys, Young, Loud, and Snotty is my pick from this era.
That's a great choice. That I did not know that about either Bob Clearmountain nor John Belushi, but
Yeah.
kind of makes sense. One thing when I first heard it, the one thing that appealed to me was that they I think it's this album where they cover "Little Girl" by the Syndicate of Sound from the '60s. It's one of those Nuggets types, but I always felt like they had an affinity for that garage rock.
Yep.
Which made it kind of cool. Like they weren't just, loud and fast. They had a little bit of, they had some nuances, some subtleties that, weren't
Yeah.
just, they
The
could, they knew what they.
interesting thing about the second album, which is not as good as this one, but that was actually produced by Felix Pappalardi, who was in the band Mountain, and he produced some, I think he worked with Cream and stuff as well. So that's another interesting connection with the Dead Boys there.
Yeah, and you always think that I always thought that these guys were like aliens, like who's heard of these bands or anything, but clearly there was a network of both, young tastemakers and even established music people that they knew there was something there. So
Yep.
that's kind of cool. All right. So we're gonna talk. We're just gonna mention a couple kind of honorable mentions if this. If you want to do any more research on this era, you can go to the first New York Dolls album,
Yeah,
self-titled.
produced by Todd Rundgren.
Yes. Stooges Funhouse.
Yeah. Stone Cold classic, 10 out of 10, no
Yo,
doubt.
totally. And the sequencing on that, I think, is brilliant. Where you've got, three burn burners, and then you get dirt because you
Yeah.
need that. You need that rest, and then it just fires back up again on side two. And then by the time LA Blues is done, you're like, I mean, I need a cold towel or something for that now. And then, the Ramones' first album, of course. I mean,
Right.
that's just goes without saying. But again, we're
Yeah.
not really, and to kind of just reiterate, we're not going to talk about the obvious stuff that we figure everybody's aware of, but we'll mention it when we need
Yeah,
it. So.
of course. Yeah. We don't need to tell you how good the Ramones are.
Right, exactly. All right, so I think that puts us out of that proto first wave, and now we're going to go into the first wave of the US. Let me clarify that.
Okay, and that is where we're going to stop things now. That was part one of Punk Weeks with Paul and Vasanth. Tune in again tomorrow for part two, where the guys are going to talk about British and Australian first wave. It's Rockin' the Suburbs, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.